Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. This is Triangulation, episode 361, recorded Friday, August 24th, 2018. Bill Atkinson, part one. Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in technology. And really, frankly, I'm going to be honest here. It's all for my benefit. These are people I just want to talk to. And there's a guy everybody in Silicon Valley idolizes, loves, respects, a name that when you say it, people just go, yes, indeed, we're not worthy. And we're talking about this guy. This is our interview that we did some time ago with Bill Atkinson, the legend who created the Apple Lisa, QuickDraw, Mac Paint, HyperCard. That was Apple. Then went on to General Magic, created the Magic Link. This is printed on PhotoCard, which is his amazing, which I still use all the time. This is how all our Twit Christmas cards are printed through PhotoCard. Great way to make a beautiful memory of your photography. And so much more. He's into some new things, and I thought we would take this time to catch up. Hi, Bill. It's great to see you again.
Hi, great.
You
you did the best interviews with me. Well, anybody that's interviewed me, your interviews that you did two and a half years ago are the ones that I cherish and I send people to. I said,
thank you.
You want to learn about me? Listen to these.
Well, good. Maybe we'll have some more to add to that list. Since we saw you, a course of tragedy in your life, when we last got together, your wife, Sue, of many years, was pretty ill, mm-hmm. and she's passed away since then.
Yeah.
I think that's got to be the biggest change in your life since we saw each other.
Well, life moves on.
Yeah.
She died a little over 2 years ago. So
you were married 28 years?
Yeah.
It's a long time.
And she was... I met her working on HyperCard, and she was the technical lead of the quality assurance team, and she brought me bugs, and I fixed them, and she brought me so many bugs, I married her.
That's so romantic.
And then when I left Apple after 12 years, when I left to form General Magic with Mark and Andy, she came with me there, and she worked on Telescript, the remote programming language.
Yeah.
And... then when I retired from General Magic in the end of 95, she ran Bill Atkinson Photography, my nature photography business. And she made a whole set of HyperCard stacks to control inventory and equipment depreciation and all. There's all kinds of forms you have to do when you're a corporation. And she did all of that.
If people download PhotoCard, which is available on iOS... right now, and it's a free download. Many of your nature images are in there as kind mm-hmm. of the stock images that come with it, and you'll see what a great photographer. I'm sad that you're kind of moving on from photography, right?
Well, one thing I found is the galleries were selling these pictures to people I'd never meet. They were keeping most of the money.
Yeah.
And they were wanting it, make me a canvas print this week. And it became a job. And then all of this reporting stuff that has to do with being a corporation and the equipment depreciation and all that kind of stuff was beyond me. I'm not so detail-oriented.
Right.
Sue did it as a favor. She didn't really like doing it, but she did it as a favor to me.
Right.
And she was very meticulous and organized. And when she died, I said, I don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah. I understand.
So I told the galleries I'm not going to be supplying prints anymore. I still make some canvas prints.
Would you bring me the one that he very
friends.
Generously has brought us? I am happy to say I have a couple of Atkinsons. This is
They're collector's items now that I don't make them anymore.
These are, this is something you were doing towards the end. And we talked about this last time you were in. You were doing thin sections of minerals, of stones.
sliced and polished rocks.
Yeah.
And this is a piece of ocean jasper from Madagascar. And to me, it looks like some kind of a star nursery, a nebula or something.
It does.
And what I try not to do is interpret it for other people. I let them see their own images in it. Why I went to the canvas prints is there's sort of nothing between you and the image. Yeah. It's a lot more work to make these. Yeah. But I find for a given wall space, it becomes a much bigger image. And instead of sort of an object on the wall with a mat and a frame and some plexi kind of putting glare on top of it, it's all image. Yeah. And it becomes, instead of an object on the wall, it becomes kind of a window into another world.
I love it.
I like the canvas ones better, even though they're harder to make. I eventually ended up making a robot to spray them because I couldn't spray them evenly enough. I would have to walk back and forth
with a fixative on top of it.
So after they've been printed in a professional wide-format inkjet printer with pigment inks, then they're still very fragile at that point.
Oh, okay.
And they also don't have a full range of color and full range of tonality. So they have to be coated. And the spray coating, I used to use a vertical easel and walk back and forth, trying to walk at the same speed, trying to keep the gun the same distance away, and trying to overlap the same amount each time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And often I would get, you have to spray it fairly wet, and often I'd get a dribble, and that would ruin the print. You have to go back and make a whole new print. No. So I worked out a way to have it horizontal and have the spray come straight down, and the coating is fed through a tube to the air gun. And I made a big stepper motor, 8-foot plotter that would drive the spray gun to coat them for me.
You started photography when you were a kid. Your mom started doing photography.
Here,
you could take this.
I've always...
Take good care of that. That's precious. Hmm. That's an original Atkinson.
When I was 10 years old, my mom got me a subscription to Arizona Highways magazine. And there were these glowing aspen pictures from Joseph Munch. That's David's father, Mark's grandfather.
Oh.
And I would cut them out and mat them and put them on my wall as a 10-year-old. And I thought, you know, I want to make pictures that can inspire and nourish
That's
people.
Neat. That's
so
neat.
I built a darkroom. And I could only do black and white. And then finally I got a job in Arthur Mintz's portrait studio in Los Gatos while I was in high school, and I could use, the agreement was I could use their color darkroom on Sunday. And so I would go around, tromping around, making nature photos. My mom was, she thought my nature photography was important. I was an avowed atheist, but I was spiritual. I just didn't believe in the organized religion things. And she said she thought my nature photography was an important part of my spirituality. So even though she was a busy woman, she was an obstetrician, she would drive me over to Boulder Creek before I had a driver's license and sit there knitting and reading so that I could tromp around and make nature photos. And she had a Freon air horn from the ice hockey games so she could recall me if her beeper went off.
Because she was on call.
She commissioned me to make 4 large prints for her doctor's waiting room, symbolizing earth, air, fire, and water. And so definitely I got a lot of my inspiration to do nature photography from my mom.
She sounds like she was a really important influence.
She was. She was my role model. Yeah. I loved her, and I think I was her favorite of 7. She had 7 kids. I was
7.
Third down. Well, she's an obstetrician, and she used to say she practiced what she preached. When she went to Cornell Med, she was the only woman doctor. This is now, medicine is at least 50% or maybe even 55% women.
Should have been
but
the late 30s.
But it used to be
30s.
Only men.
Yeah.
And she told the male doctors there, who kind of resented her intrusion, she said, "Would you take your car to an auto mechanic who had never driven a car? If you want to work on a woman's body, it helps to have lived in one." And they could understand that logic.
Yeah.
So she was quite an amazing woman, and she instilled in me the belief that I could accomplish anything that I set my heart on as long as I was determined and willing to work really hard. And that has put me in good stead all of my life. If she were still alive today, she'd be 100 years in a few months.
I read the piece you wrote, Happy Birthday, Mom, for her 100th. That was really moving. You told me that there are two people whose belief in you made you who you are today. Your mom was one. Who's the other?
Steve Jobs. I don't know what Jeff Raskin said to him that got him to recruit me, but he believed in me.
Yeah.
And he really gave me a lot of rope and let me do good things at Apple. Without his unshakable faith in me, I couldn't have done nearly as much.
He was right.
Well, it worked out, but...
Did he have a knack, you think, for picking talent? Because you were not a programmer. You had been working in neuroscience, right?
Yeah, I was studying consciousness and the brain. I was doing I was up at University of Washington in Seattle, working with Doug Bowden in the Regional Primate Research Center.
Oh, interesting.
And so we were doing experiments that involved cannulas going into the pleasure rewards areas of brains and being able to see how those responses were affected by minute amounts of neurotransmitter agonists in there. And I was using computers to control the lab experiments and also to reconstruct some of the data about the results. Kind of you had to take the results from one monkey and map them onto a standardized atlas. You had to sort of morph the data. And I was working away on that, and I got a call from Jeff Raskin that I knew from my undergraduate down at UC San Diego.
He was a computer scientist?
No, he was a visual artist. He was in the visual art department.
Isn't that interesting?
And in fact, his attitude toward computers is what put me in good stead when I came to do user interface design. He didn't respect computers.
Yeah.
Here's an example. The computer center had this Burroughs 5500 big BMF computer, and everybody had to type cards with a key punch and submit these decks of 80-column cards with rubber bands around them, submit them, and then we come back the next day and find there's one damn semicolon in it. You know, you have to do it all over again. And Jeff took his budget that he was supposed to spend on computer time and bought a mini computer and some bean bags and some video display terminals and set up BASIC such that you could interactively type in a little program and try it. Which is a much better environment for learning programming than submitting a deck. I mean, you could write a little program and try it now.
Right.
And the computer science department did not like him at all because they were counting on his budget.
Right.
Right.
But he
provided
was doing visual
a better
arts. So you were doing art with computers or?
Oh, he was sort of a renegade. He didn't just do what he was pigeonholed to do. So Jeff and I became friends, and for a while I lived at his place in Solana Beach. So later when I got this, come check out this cool company that's starting up in Apple, in Silicon Valley, I said, no, I need to finish my PhD.
You were in the middle of doing your doctoral.
If you don't
work.
Finish your PhD, it's kind of like a driver's license. You don't get to drive a car if you don't have a driver's license. You want to do research, you have to have that enabling credential.
Right.
And he didn't take no for an answer. He sent me a round-trip airfare with a little note saying, no strings attached, just visit for a weekend. And my dad lived in Los Gatos, not too far from Apple, so I figured, okay, I'll come down for a weekend.
Apple's pretty small this time, about 30 employees.
Yeah. And Steve Jobs, I don't know what Jeff said to him, but Steve dedicated one entire day to recruiting me. He took me around to everybody that worked at Apple. There were 30 people. They seemed like they were having fun. They were working on interesting things. And their heart was in the right place. They wanted to do something good in the world. But that wasn't enough. I had to finish. Consciousness is pretty amazing frontier, and I wanted to work on that. But toward the end of the day, Steve took me aside, and he said, when you read about some hot new technology, that really was created 2 years prior. There's a lag between the time when something's created and the time when it's available to the public. And if you want to affect the world, you have to get ahead of that lag. And come to Apple, where we're inventing the future. You can help to invent the future and affect millions of people's lives. And then, just as I was leaving, he gave me this visual. He said, think how fun it is to surf on the front edge of a wave. and how not fun to dog paddle on the tail end of the same wave. And I kind of stuck in my craw. And I,
he was a good salesman, man, I tell you.
2 weeks later, I had quit my neuroscience program.
Wow.
Never finished my degree.
Wow.
I had moved from up in Seattle down to Silicon Valley, which when I left was Santa Clara Valley.
Right. It was prune trees everywhere. Right. Yeah.
And I was working at Apple 2 weeks after
That's
his...
That's a brave thing. How did you justify that in your head?
Well...
I mean, you've thrown away years of work.
Yeah, my dad was really upset because he had co-sponsored 10 years of college education that was getting thrown away. He was livid, but...
Did you say, well, I could go back to this next year, or...
No. No. I just said, I have to do it, you know?
Wow.
I know it's the right thing to do. I don't know exactly why, but I know it's the right thing to do.
That's brave. You're in your 20s, right?
Yeah, I was... this was 40 years ago. I'm 66. I was 26 when I came to Apple.
That's a brave thing. There must have been really something there that captured your imagination.
Well, Steve was a pretty good salesman. and it worked out. Because once I was there, Steve and I became good friends. We did a lot of things together. We'd go to long walks at Castle Rock State Park. And we'd have lots of wide-ranging discussions about not just computers and stuff, but about life. And
He was kind of a deep philosopher, right? I mean, he had been to India. He was really aware of the different levels of consciousness and things like that.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah, he was.
So you got along on that level as well.
Yeah. We often had arguments, but that was great because he liked having somebody that would stand up to him that wouldn't just kowtow, you know.
Even then, people would
I've been reading Ken Kuchinda's latest book, Creative Selection.
Yeah.
And it's just really describing what it was like working at Apple after Steve came back.
Right.
In the beginning where Steve wasn't venerated so much. There was a lot of back and forth. And what I found is that Steve challenged me and provoked my best work. Sometimes I would think I had the best way to do something, and he'd end up getting me to find a better way to do it. Yeah.
How?
Well, like here's a for example. I thought, like for working on Quickdraw, the graphics primitives, what things are fundamental that should be in graphics primitives versus what things could be done at a higher level and just built on top of them. And I thought that rounded corner rectangles weren't really that fundamental.
No, it's just a square with a curve applied.
He took me out for a walk, and he says, let's look at the real world here. And he's pointed and pointed and pointed, and everything he pointed at was, he finally got to a no parking sign with rounded corner, rounded rectangle, and I said, okay.
You win.
And the next day, I had it working. And what I had to do was take the ellipse drawing tool, and basically, since you're drawing it in slabs like this, if you just start with the left side and the right side offset... Well, then you get an ellipse, but with a flat spot at the top.
Right.
And if when you get halfway down, you stop bumping for a while, then you get flat spots here. So it didn't take anything in the code. It didn't increase, it didn't make it any slower, and we could do rounded corner rectangles. So there's an example where Steve kind of saw, instead of seeing what the SIGGRAPH core graphics standard primitives were, he was looking at the world. And saying, this thing occurs a lot, you should handle it.
It helped he wasn't a computer scientist, probably, huh?
Oh, and I think it helped me be a better user interface designer than I wasn't.
Right.
I didn't like computers.
Right.
Computers were just a tool to do a job. A really good carpenter is not in love with his hammer. He'll use whatever tool is available. And what Jeff Raskin taught me was that the human time is what's valuable, not the computer time. So for an event loop, and here you've got a powerful computer that's sitting there. Is anything happening? They type anything? Did the mouse move?
This computer has been sitting here for a lifetime.
You're
from
wasting
its point of view.
That computer's resource in order to be responsive when a human does something.
But in the,
and that's the opposite of preparing a deck of cards for punch cards and submitting them to the B5500.
Yeah, they measured CPU usage. That's what you paid for.
Yeah.
Yeah. How much time on the computer used.
And what you should measure is the human time.
That makes perfect sense. That was what changed the world. That's why Apple
was so significant.
And
I got that aesthetic from Jeff Roskin.
Yeah. Do you remember what your first assignment was when you came down from Washington?
Yes. I was hired in as the application software department. There wasn't one.
And this is for an Apple II at this time.
Yeah. Apple thought, well, we make hardware and software is sort of a necessary evil to make the hardware useful. And so I collected cassette tapes. We didn't have a floppy disk back then. I collected cassette tapes of software that users had made and
in Apple
put
Basic,
them together.
Probably, right?
Either in Integer Basic later in Apple Soft Basic, right. The Microsoft's Basic that had strings and floating point. And I would assemble them into a sort of mixtapes that would be sent out to all the clubs so that they could share.
I remember that. You'd go to the user group and they'd have tables with the cassettes and later floppies that, yeah.
One of the things I learned from that was because the I.O. game paddles weren't on, not everybody had them, you couldn't write software that counted on them.
Ah.
So later when we went to do the Lisa, that's why I insisted that the mouse be in the box so we could count on it. So when you do a graphics editor, we'd know that they had a pointing device. And that was a little bit of a hard sell, but I convinced, I think Tom Whitney was the one who finally had to make the call on that.
Yeah.
But so that was the first thing I did. Then I said, well, we need to get a better development environment. So Apple was a hacker. A hacker's hacker, great hacker, but he wasn't a disciplined, structured programming guy.
He didn't have a computer science background either, right?
We should port the UCSD Pascal system onto the Apple II. And my manager, Roy Martin, said, no, we don't need that. And I went over his head to Steve. And Steve said, I think our users are quite happy with basic and assembly language, the 6502 assembly. And I was passionate about it. He said, well, since you're so passionate about it, I'll give you 2 weeks to convince me otherwise. So I was on a plane that afternoon down to UC San Diego. I never bothered to get a hotel because I just worked and slept on the lab benches. At one point, and UCSD had done most of the hard work. They had made a 6502 interpreter.
It was a P system, right?
Yeah. And they'd made a 6502P code interpreter. So the port was relatively easy. What I really had to do is plug in graphics, which was a little bit tough because Apple II's graphics were a little bit screwed up.
There were WAS graphics.
high-res graphics had 7 pixels in a row or in a byte, and then the high bit in that byte shifts these all over a half. Oh, great. And then the next scan line
chips.
Was somewhere else completely in memory.
This is WAS saving chips, getting one fewer chip on the board.
Yeah.
Basically.
Well, he was very clever, but sometimes cleverness costs.
Yeah.
And the other thing I had to do is plug in the disk routines. Now, the UCSD Pascal system was big enough that it wasn't going to fit well on our 13-sector floppy disks. These are 5 1/4-inch disks. And WAS had come up with a new way to pack the data called 16-sector.
Yeah.
And so he came down to UCSD to help me install the 16-sector disk routines. We were going to use the 16-sector for the release of the Pascal. And I watched him typing. And he would type not in assembly and then assemble it. He would type in hex, object code, and then disassemble to check himself. But
he was writing machine language.
Yeah. So he would type. And I asked him, what was the pause? He says, forward branch, 7 instructions. And he had to compute how many instructions there were and how many bytes each would take so he'd know what the offset was. So instead of going back and patching the offset, he would just type it the first time. And then he would disassemble it. Well, one of my jobs then was to take his disassemble and comment it and try to put English language comments. What is he doing? And I did, and he was amazed. He said, I can't believe you understood my 16-sector disk packing, my nibble coding. He says, did I get it right?
Wow.
So that was the first actual a source code listing of the 16 sector disk routines that had comments in it.
And it was reverse assembled.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was after doing the Lisa project. Steve said he wanted me to work on, the UCSD Pascal project. After doing that,
why did you think Pascal was important compared to Integer Basic?
So it had local variables and modules in such a way that you could build in a cumulative fashion.
It has scoping,
so
lexical
the
scoping.
The AppleSoft Basic, the variable names.
They're all global.
Not only are they all global, but they're only significant in the first two characters. So if you make...
So we have 26 by 26 possibilities, period.
Well, because you could do 0, 0 through 9, it had sort of, 36 by 36 possibilities. And we actually made charts of A through 9, and by A through 9, you check off the variables you'd use.
I've used that one.
But if someone else wanted to call one of those routines, they had to make sure none of their code stepped on your variables.
Right.
So we needed...
Pretty primitive.
Yes. We needed an environment that allowed you to build libraries in a cumulative fashion.
Right.
Where not everybody had to have the complete source code, for example, to QuickDraw, in order to make calls onto QuickDraw. So that's why I wanted the Pascal system. We ended up using that to bootstrap the Lisa. And that's the next project to work on. Steve asked me to work on that. And so I had plugged the graphics into there. I did into Pascal system. I said, okay, well, I'll do the graphics for the Lisa. And at first, Lisa was going to be a bit slice processor, custom designed just for Apple. There would be no other computers anywhere in the world that used this custom bit slice. And somewhere along the line, Rich Page, the hardware guru on the Lisa, convinced us. Well, Motorola got good silicon the first turn on the 68000, and he says we should be using this. And there was a big fight over that, and we got to use it, and it was a beautiful processor with a big address space and clean addressing, and
didn't have any of that segmented
and
stuff.
And that allowed
that
me to write the QuickDraw graphics primitives
in
highly optimized 68000 assembly language with unrolled loops and everything. I remember my motto of the time is measure before you optimize. Don't, figure out where
optimize
is the performance
in the important
going.
Spot, not just in general.
Right.
Yeah.
See where it's too slow.
Right.
Where it's actually painfully too slow to the end user.
Right.
And figure out where is it spending its time.
No need to optimize the event loop because.
Yeah. So I did QuickDraw, and QuickDraw enabled the graphical user interface. Without it, it wouldn't have been practical. Our computers before then, you would put a byte in a memory location, and it would show up on the screen through a character generator ROM.
Right.
Well, with a full bitmap display, you have a lot of flexibility about what you can draw.
You could draw off screen.
And you can draw lines not just characters. You don't have a character generator ROM, so you can draw areas and curves and lines and characters and variable width text, proportional space to text. But it was at a big cost. Each pixel had to be set or cleared. A lot of memory accesses to do that drawing. And if it weren't done efficiently, things would be, maybe 100 times too slow to be practical.
It was was the first Lisa a megapixel display? Was it?
No. It was 720 pixels across by 360, and they weren't even square pixels. They were taller. They were two-thirds taller. They were two-thirds as wide as they were tall.
That's challenging.
Yes, and that became a problem when they went to do what they called the Mac XL, which was a Lisa rebranded.
Right.
They had to go to a new... I think they had to go to square pixels on that.
How much of QuickDraw lives in the modern Mac? Is there
the very modern Mac? Probably very little.
Yeah.
The next step stuff had beautiful PostScript based graphics. A lot of what was in QuickDraw was because of the display being 1 bit. And in one long word, there were 32 adjacent pixels. So you had to take this character and split it up into pieces of a word. You couldn't...
A lot of bit shifting going
on. And masking and dropping. Whereas in the later displays, a pixel was a byte or was 4 bytes. If it was a color, it might be a 4 byte. So I don't think much of QuickDraw is still in the current shipping Macs.
The beauty of QuickDraw is that you had so little memory, you had so many pixels, and you had a lot to do. In fact, the Macintosh ROM was an amazing creation, really.
Macintosh ROM had, in order to do the overlapped windows and the clipping for them, kind of the window manager had to be a little bit in bed with the graphics in order to know how to clip.
Right. And that's what part to show, what part not to show.
Yeah, when you draw into a window that's behind another one, how do you not trash the one that's in front?
Right.
And actually, there's a funny story there that we had gone to see a demo at Xerox PARC of their older machine, the Alto.
Yeah. This is that famous demo.
And we thought that I thought I had seen drawing into the behind window. So I knew it was possible to rapidly draw into a window that was partially obscured.
They did it at PARC.
Yeah. And so I figured there must be a way. And I invented a way called Regions that did it very efficiently. Later, somebody from PARC said, "How did you do that?" And I said, "Didn't you guys do it?" "Oh, no. When we draw into the hack one, we would draw a clip to a rectangle. Then we have to redraw all of the other windows one at a time in front of it."
Oh, my gosh.
And there was a lot of flicker. How did you avoid that? So I had to write the window manager for the Lisa and the event manager and the menu manager. So I came up with the pull-down menus.
You invented the pull-down menu.
Yeah. There was a time.
How did we do it before then?
Well, we were still developing. Before that, we used to have a row of keys across the bottom that were soft keys.
Yeah.
And they correspond to keys on the keyboard.
Yeah.
And their labels would change when you did something because real live applications need more than 10 total commands.
Right.
Right. So if you pressed one of these, then all of them would relabel, and you press another one. But it was very dangerous because people didn't read the labels, right?
So
they'd go, this.
This is called the type bar.
Delete, yes, confirm. Oh, wait a minute. I didn't mean to do that. We went through a series of user interfaces. One of the big changes was going to a white background. So we started the Lisa user interface with a black background and white characters.
All computers in those days, had black screens with either amber or green text on them.
Right. And my argument was that if you want to do graphics, you have to go to a white background. And the reason is you're going to print on white paper. You're never going to print on black paper.
Right.
And if you're doing text, then it's okay if the text goes inverse between what you see on the screen and what you print. You print black characters on the paper, but you see them white on the screen. But you can't do that with a photo. You don't want it to go negative.
No.
And the Lisa hardware guys, they were not too happy with this because it was going to draw more power. It's going
to
require a faster refresh.
Yeah.
It's going to require a faster phosphor that was going to require more expensive RAM to support the video RAM. They did not want this. And it was going to flicker in front of you, right? And Steve Jobs had to make the call, but I was the lone voice saying, "You've got to go white background." And he listened to my logic that if you want to do graphics right, you have to do a white background.
You were right, of course.
So he made that call.
Yeah, yeah.
So the Lisa user interface evolved. I'd say we engineered it into existence a piece at a time. We tried a lot of things, and a lot of things didn't work.
Yeah.
We made a half-silvered mirror, a dark room adjacent to a light room with a half-silvered mirror, and a video camera on the keyboard and the mouse, and another one on the screen with the person's face reflected in it. And we recruited test subjects that were usually spouses of Apple employees. But we didn't want somebody who was familiar with computers, but we wanted somebody, who we could trust to not talk.
Yeah.
And we'd give them a task, like, here, edit this document and save it.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, we learned things from this that allowed us to make it differently. One time, we got to a point where a person was supposed to choose between do it and cancel. He'd look a little miffed, and they'd hit cancel. And we said, "Wait a minute, we saw that last week. Another guy did that. In fact, there was a third one." And we turned up the volume on the tapes and played it back, and he says, "What's this dolt?" "I'm no dolt," so we hit cancel. So we knew as programmers that said D-O uppercase I-T, do it.
Yeah.
But And so because we knew that, we had a blind spot. We couldn't possibly see it as dolt.
Yeah.
And yet three different people
said dolt.
And the next day it was okay and canceled. Now, we didn't like okay because it was an abbreviation. It was colloquialism. But, it worked.
That's amazing. So, how much of that park demo influenced what you were doing? I mean,
it gave us the inspiration that we really did want to do a bitmap display.
Yep. Wasn't their display white too, though? I mean,
yes,
on the Alto.
Oh yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And that was after we had decided to go.
Oh, this was after that.
Yeah.
Okay. So see, this is interesting. I didn't realize. I thought that
we had a bitmap display before we went to
the history of it. People imply was that you guys went, you looked at Park, and you said, "Oh, we should be doing that." But you had already been working on Lisa for a while, obviously.
Yes. Yeah.
When you saw this demo,
so there are aspects of that are true and aspects that are not.
Yeah.
The folklore is that we copied from Park.
You stole it.
Right. No, there was so much engineering had to go on top of what we saw. What the Xerox
and sometimes what you saw
gave
wasn't...
us was inspiration
rather
than how to do it.
Yeah.
For example, on Park, they didn't have the pull-down menus.
Right.
They had little pop-up menus, and you got like five or six items.
I remember
that. But how
do
you do a real application with that?
You still
see
that.
Well, they would get a different pop-up depending on where you were when you pressed the mouse. And
Smalltalk still does.
So our first versions had sort of like pull-down menus, but at the top of each window, like the early versions of Microsoft Windows did.
Yeah.
And the problem with that is when the window is narrow, you don't get them all.
Mm-hmm.
When the window is shorter, near the bottom of the screen, you don't get all the choices. And I remember when I put them up at the top of the whole screen, the Lisa development team screamed bloody murder. They said, "Oh, no, you can't do that. We'll have to reach way too far," you know? And I said, well, something that's beautiful about it is you always get the full width.
Mm-hmm.
You always get the full height.
Mm-hmm.
And they have kind of a kinesthetic feel. This thing is over here. So you can kind of be reaching for it before you even got it in your mind of exactly what you're going to choose. If it's file related, it'll be over in that corner someplace, right?
Muscle memory is really important.
Yes. And so what we did to counter the objections was make it so that you could quickly get to the top of the screen. Well, to quickly get to the top of the screen, what that meant is that if you move the mouse quickly, then the gear ratio between millimeters on the table and millimeters on the screen would kick into high gear.
Acceleration.
Right? And will pin at the top. So
perfect.
A little jerk like this would get it to the top.
Perfect.
Because it wouldn't go any further than the top.
Right.
Well, people didn't like that. They said, the mouse is going to walk off the table. And it does. Every now and then you have to pick up the mouse
reposition.
Reposition.
Yeah, yeah.
But it worked. So we engineered it into existence by trial and error.
Yeah. We take it so for granted now that it almost is for the modern user, well, it has to be that way. But you were working at a time when it didn't have to be anyway. It wasn't invented.
For example, which way should scroll arrows go? Okay, when you scroll a document so that you see more of what's below, there's an argument for an arrow that points down to what's below. There's another argument, because when you do that, in order to see more of what's below, the document's going to slide up, right?
Right.
There's an argument for an arrow that goes up.
Yeah.
And so we tried different combinations of which way the arrows would point and tried them on users, naive users, and damned if it wasn't 50-50. You'd say, show me what's later, and they would 50-50. It wasn't even 60-40, which one they would go to. And I tried an experiment. I moved the two arrows apart. They never got it wrong then. When they wanted to see what was below, they go to the one that was at the bottom. And when they go to the top, more was above, they go to the one that's above.
Perfect.
And so, not perfect, because now if you overshot, then you had to reach all the way back there.
Right.
But people understood it right away.
Yeah.
So a lot of these things... I know I got in a little bit of trouble with Apple when there was this look and feel suit between Microsoft and Apple, and Microsoft was saying that Apple was saying, well, it's copyrightable because we invented it, you know. And my testimony was that, well, if you put enough engineers on it and did enough user testing, you would come up with the same conclusions.
Oops.
That dolt doesn't work and the arrows, their placement matters more than which way the arrow is.
Yeah.
So Apple didn't really like that answer. But I had to answer truthfully.
You're an engineer.
Although in those depositions, I got one on the Microsoft guys. The Microsoft mean pit bull lawyer says, Mr. Atkinson, do you ever tell a lie? Not under oath.
Oh, perfect answer.
He's trying really hard not to crack a grin, and he moved on to another topic.
Perfect answer. I'll remember that the next time I'm deposed.
Okay, not under oath, so sir. We were making the Lisa user interface, and we were talking a little bit about the Mac ROM. So the event manager, window manager, and menu manager that I wrote for Lisa needed to be squeezed into this teeny little ROM for the Mac.
How much room did you have?
The original Mac was 100. It was, I think, 96K.
Okay.
And there's only 128K of RAM.
Right.
And the original ROM, two-thirds of the code was... So Andy Hertzfeld took my Lisa, window manager, manager, and menu manager, and squeezed them into assembly language just for space, just to get them smaller.
Right.
And
it was written in
and
Pascal
then quick
originally?
Draw. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so QuickDraw, which is already in optimized assembly,
right.
QuickDraw plus those three ended up accounting for about two-thirds of the original Mac ROM.
Wow.
So I had a lot of code in there.
Yeah.
Now, one of the reasons Apple put that stuff in the ROM is so that application writers would be highly motivated to do it in a consistent fashion.
Yeah.
If you wanted to do your own kind of scrolling, you could roll your own. But
who would?
If there's this in the ROM,
it's
you can just
in.
Call it, then it's cheaper for them.
It was brilliant.
So user interface, rather than by, fascisti commands must use, we just made it easier for them to do it in a standardized way.
There were user interface guidelines, though, and I always thought they were really kind of brilliant. They were well thought out. Things like the concept of monotony. Of doing it one way and not...
Between different apps.
Yeah.
Larry Tesler was really the king of that on the Lisa. He said it's important that all of that... There were apps that ship with the Lisa. There were 6 or 8 built-in apps. And it was important that all the file menus look the same. And all of the, the things that were common between apps should be done in the same way. And Larry was really good at kind of writing herd on the app developers and getting them all to kind of do it the same
way.
And
there shouldn't be more than one way to do the same thing. That there was a way to do something, to save a file or open a file, that just was the one way. I mean, that's one of the things that Windows, I think, got wrong, is they made it... It's kind of... it's like Perl, where there's more than one way to do things. They made it so easy to do...
You want to make it so that it's possible to do it differently... But there's enough inertia that you only do it differently if you're doing it significantly better.
Right.
And
right.
then other people should adopt your better way.
right.
That way you kind of ratchet it up.
I'm going to take a little break. I apologize because we have so much that we want to talk about. And I didn't want to take you down memory lane too far. But, this is...
You were showing this card with the last interview 2.5 years ago.
Yes.
And I had 4 license plates then.
Look at that.
And... Now I have 7.
So you asked me before the show, why don't you have personalized plates?
Yeah.
Why do you have personalized plates? Why do you like so many?
I find that my car creates a personal identity.
Yeah.
I am the guy who's driving that car.
Yeah.
For example, I'm now driving a Tesla with Karma to You on it. And having that Karma to You plate makes me be more polite in traffic.
Oh, because it's you.
I don't cut somebody else off if it says Karma to You. You know?
All right. Maybe I have to rethink my get a personalized plate.
Well, because that's who I am now.
Yeah.
So, I was Graph Man when I was working on the graphics primitives for Lisa and Mac.
Right.
Fat Bits when I was working on Mac Paint.
Right.
HyperCard when I was working on HyperCard. GN Magic at General Magic. BA Photo, Bill Atkinson Photography.
Right.
Photo Card, my postcard app, and Karma to You.
Now, Karma to You.
So the license plate to me is a little bit of my identity. Who am I?
Right.
I'm the guy that drives Karma to You now.
Right. I want to take a little break, and we can talk a little bit about General Magic. There was, in fact, we had the filmmakers on a few weeks ago, a really interesting documentary about General Magic. You were one of the principals.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about your perspective. And I think you brought the purpose statement, right, for General Magic that you wrote.
Do you want me to read it now?
Not now. We're
going
to take a break, and that's next.
And I'll tell you, that film really helped me a lot.
Did it?
It was very healing to me.
Yeah.
Because I had a lot of shame about our failure, and a lot of I brought great people to work there on our project.
Yeah.
And we failed.
Yeah.
And I felt like I had misled them. But the film really showed me, you know, we had a hell of a lot of fun. We ended up sowing a lot of seeds that ended up bearing fruit in the future, even if we couldn't make an iPhone back in 1994.
Right. Of course you couldn't. I think Mark Porat shared that kind of feeling of shame and failure.
Yeah.
And that's actually a very poignant moment in the movie. The filmmakers, I thought, did a really good job. And I loved seeing Megan Smith, because we know Megan Smith from Google and then CTO of the United States. I had no idea she was that young engineer.
Oh, she was a HyperCard enthusiast.
Was she?
Oh, yeah. I met her in Apple, Japan, and she was using HyperCard with teachers to do amazing creative stuff with kids.
Oh, that's neat.
And she was into multimedia. I went to Japan and gave some tours for Apple on using HyperCard in multimedia.
Oh, that's great.
Well, I love Megan. She has an indomitable spirit.
She's an amazing person, but she's wonderful in that. Well, we'll talk about General Magic. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, you have a magic link that works.
Yes, I do. I can do a live demo
of
the General Magic user interface.
That's next as we continue to, our special guest, always special to have Bill in the studio, Bill Atkinson, the creator of so much that we know and use today. Including drop-down menus. Where would we be today if we had a right-click on the desktop to get a menu? Boy, that'd be annoying.
We'd be on an iPad.
Oh, yeah.
They don't use pull-down menus.
We've come full circle in some ways, haven't we? Isn't that interesting? Our show today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage. If it's time to buy a house, it's an interesting situation to be in. It's both exciting, right? That new house, somewhere you're going to live in for a long time. Your family is going to be there. It's a big deal, but at the same time, it's also the biggest check you'll ever write, the biggest purchase you'll ever make. It can be a little anxious making. The folks at Quicken Loans know that. They are the biggest and best lender in the country. In fact, number one in customer satisfaction for 8 years in a row, according to J.D. Power, in mortgage origination. Mortgage servicing, 5 consecutive years. They're very customer focused, and they realized that something has changed in getting a loan in the last few months, and that is that interest rates have started to go back up. For a while, they were flat. And when you were buying a house, you might not have really paid much attention to that, right? The rate is the rate. But now as you're buying and the rates are ticking up, there's a clock ticking. There's this feeling of, you know, if I don't buy this house now, it could go up a quarter point. That doesn't sound like much, but over 30 years, that's tens of thousands of dollars. That's a big deal. And the last thing you want is pressure when you're buying this most important purchase of your life. You want to be able to get the house you want, not just jump at the first thing you see. Quicken Loans has created Rocket Mortgage to solve a lot of these problems. First of all, it's entirely online. You can get the loan. You can apply for the loan on your phone if you want. You could do it on your iPad. You could do it on a desktop. All you have to do is go to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation, answer a few questions. Based on your answers, once you give them permission, they'll get all the information they need, income, assets, and credit, to give you an offer. They can do that in just a few minutes. That's the beginning of what they call the power buying process. That's what they call qualified approval. Then, within 24 hours, they'll verify all of that and give you verified approval. That's huge. Now you have the strength of a cash buyer. If you're making an offer on a house and you've got verified approval, puts you right at the front of the line. The seller says, they're good for it. I know they are. They're verified. But here's the best part. Once you're verified, you qualify for their all-new Rate Shield approval. And this is the thing that takes that anxiety out. Actually, all of this is, you know, helps get rid of the anxiety. But now, you know, you're locked. Your interest rate is locked for up to 90 days. So you have up to 3 months to shop, and the interest rates can't go up. If they go up, they go up, but yours stays the same. If they go down, by the way, it would go down as well. So you win either way. That is pretty sweet. Rate Shield approval. It's exactly what you'd expect from America's best mortgage lender. To get started, it's simple. Do this on your phone. You can do it right now. Get started. RocketMortgage.com/triangulation. Rate shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. You don't have to remember all that. Just remember this, rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Take the anxiety out of hunting for your new home. rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. We thank them for making our conversation with Bill Atkinson possible. You brought a stack of cards. You want to go through some of those? And we have to catch up with Bill and all the things that have happened in 2.5 years.
This is Sue working at General Magic.
Okay.
I've got pictures of the kids here. She's working on Telescript, a remote programming language that allowed you to send a program out to a server, and it would execute it there.
Wow. That was pretty forward-thinking. I mean, this is 94.
Very forward-thinking. We have kind of the reverse of that now. Servers can download a little bit of JavaScript to your program, your computer, where it executes, but we still don't have the Telescript.
How interesting. What else do you have here? Oh, there are you and Sue.
She said, I'm going to die, and before
did
I
she
go...
she have cancer? Was,
yeah, she had blood cancer called multiple myeloma.
Oh, dear.
Usually gets people in 3 years, and with my help, she lasted 8.
Wow.
And she said, I'm going to die, and I don't want you to be alone, so we have to get a new dog. So this is our dog, Poppy.
Oh.
And here's a picture she took. She's in the slider here.
Oh, yeah.
Taking this picture with her iPhone of Poppy when Poppy was 6 months old. And then after she died, I made a little memorial with some canvas prints of her and a bunch of photo cards of our 28-year marriage.
This was the thing that I loved about photo cards, and I gather this kind of inspired photo cards, is this idea that you have all these digital images, but they're hidden away on a hard drive. And having a high-quality, and these are really high-quality, print of these images, you can do things with them. You put them up on the wall. You can
They're in your face. Each day you're remembering. So I have different displays. I've got one that's kind of a memorial of our time together. By the breakfast nook, I have two that are sort of current events, friendships and activities that are going on now.
You change them all the time?
Yeah.
Nice.
And
that's a nice
rotate
idea.
Rotate them out.
This is, by the way, a free program you can get at photocard.com. You can send them as an email for free, and then your correspondent can print it.
You get it at the Apple Store.
At the App Store.
Not photocard.com.
No, did I say photo? I'm so sorry, Bill. Yeah, the App Store. It's a free app for
iOS. It's called
Photocard
by Bill Atkinson. It's a free app. And I take care of printing and mailing them. And it's a real pain.
It's a lot of work. People using it. I have to use it more. I have to remember to use it because I love these cards. And I send, whenever I have an image I really want to save, I send it to myself or send it to Lisa. There's one of your beautiful photos being printed.
So after Sue died, I stopped selling my canvas prints in the galleries, and I still give them to some friends. And I did some work. After Sue died, I was in a lot of hurt.
Yeah.
And I did some research, and I found a psycho-spiritual healing that worked for me. I'm my background is a neuroscientist, and I started thinking about consciousness. And
you know, what's cool is that you've come back.
Yeah,
to
full
doing
circle.
what you started.
This is what I would have been working on if I hadn't gone to Apple 40 years ago.
Yeah. So you took a little break.
And so I made some molecule models. I'm a kinesthetic learner. I don't think I understand something until I can hold it and move it around and play with it.
You actually have some of these models.
Yeah.
These are molecular models of psychoactive chemicals. Now, I want to say before we get too far into this, I really want you to speak freely, and you have spoken very freely on this show in the past about use of psychoactive drugs.
But you don't condone it.
Well, I think when you hear what Bill has to say, it might sound like a very big ad for this.
Right.
But it really isn't something that you can take lightly. These are significantly powerful drugs. Not drugs. It's not really the word chemicals.
They're part of how our brains work.
Yeah, and you're modifying. These are very often analogs or even identical endogenous versions of these chemicals are already in your brain, but you're changing this. So I want to just say before we go too far into this, that you really, this is not advocating that people use these drugs. You certainly shouldn't use them recreationally. Mm-hmm. This is a very serious topic. But Bill, we have some books. Bill will show you some books you can read if you want to learn more about this, and I would advocate that. If you're under 21, don't touch this stuff. Your brain is is too malleable.
Guess what? The under 21s are the ones that are doing it the most.
I know, and they should stop
and
right
they're
now,
using
kids.
It in a in not a really
not a safe
sacred way.
A sacred way. That's important.
So this stuff is a really important tool for understanding consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is tryptophan. This is one of the 20 amino acids that all proteins are built out of.
This is what puts you to sleep after a turkey dinner, right?
Well, that's an oversimplification, but true. Yeah.
Okay.
Now,
that's
tryptophan.
L-tryptophan.
Tryptophan, yeah. If you do a minor modification to it, you take off the COOH, you get tryptamine.
Tryptamine.
Okay. And what makes something a tryptamine is it has this six-membered carbon ring and then a five-membered ring where one of them is a nitrogen. This is called an indole ring, and this has two carbons off of it and one nitrogen. So carbon is black, and hydrogens are white, and the nitrogens are blue. Well, this is tryptamine. There's an enzyme in every organism that converts back and forth between tryptophan and tryptamine.
So these are chemicals endogenously already in your brain.
Every organism. We only have 20 amino acids we build all proteins out of. This is one of the 20.
So every living creature has these.
Yes.
Interesting.
From amoebas to bears.
Wow.
And the enzyme to convert these is present in all of these different. Now, if you take this guy and you add one little hydroxy over here, the only difference is we've added oxygen and a hydrogen. That's serotonin. Serotonin is the neurotransmitter that's most affected in emotional stuff.
Yeah.
It's an oversimplification to say that, because it's also involved in our gut, in our we digest, but
all sorts of stuff.
Serotonin is a very important neurotransmitter.
Yeah.
And it's only a couple of steps away from the tryptophan.
Well, that makes sense. That's how we make it in the body, right? There's
now, if you take this tryptamine, and instead of adding an OH over here to make serotonin, what if you take these two hydrogens and replace them with methyls?
Okay.
Methyl is CH3.
Okay.
You get something called dimethyltryptamine. DMT is a very strong psychedelic that is very fast-acting and kind of overwhelming.
Yeah.
If you take it orally, nothing happens. If you take it IV or snorting it, or smoking it, it's like this amazing rush of stuff. I haven't actually done this myself. I've read about it.
We should say right now that it is a Class 3 narcotic.
Schedule 1
narcotic.
A Schedule 1 drug.
Drug. Yeah. It is highly illegal.
Illegal.
And is not available in any way legally. Maybe in research. I think there is more research now on the use of these psychoactive.
And in fact, in 1990 to 1994, Rick Strassman, a psychiatrist at University of New Mexico, did studies on this.
Yeah.
If you inject this IV into volunteers, they go on, they reach a peak in 4 minutes and back to baseline in 15.
Who would volunteer for this?
Well, 60 volunteers.
Really?
And,
okay. What is the experience?
This significant portion of the people receiving the high dose reported interacting with otherworldly beings.
Oh, boy.
Where the hell has that come from?
Oh, boy.
If you take this guy and...
You have some theories, which we'll get to, where this might be coming from.
If you take this guy and add...
you haven't done this, though. That's interesting. I haven't done
DMT.
Yeah.
Or...
Nor have I. I think Bill and I have both talked about our experiences with LSD. In fact, you told us last time you were here that LSD inspired HyperCard because you realized the interconnectivity of all things.
Well, if you add one methoxy here.
Yeah.
You get 5-methoxy-DMT, which this one is thought of as the spirit molecule. There's a great book called DMT, the Spirit Molecule, that Rick Strassman wrote. And the best way to digest this, actually, is to go to Netflix and watch a 2-hour video form of it.
Okay. Again, we're not advocating that anybody do this on their own.
But if you're curious about what this thing does.
But it's interesting. There actually is a lot of... There's a next step to understand after this, which we'll get to.
And I'm looking at structure, function, relationships. Why do these affect the brain in a certain way?
Why do you build these models? How does that help you do that?
Well, if you look at the printed diagram of this, these don't look very similar.
Yeah.
But if you look at it
you can see this
is exactly the same as this.
With that.
Except this got a phosphoryl group on it here.
Right.
And this is psilocybin. This
Isn't
is a very gentle high. This is the mushroom high.
Right.
This is the active ingredient mushroom. Actually, it gets digested. That gets it through the gut, and it becomes becomes psilocin, which is only 1-OH different.
Now, I've never heard of psilocin. What is that?
Well, it's what psilocybin
turns into.
Turns into. That phosphoryl group there gets replaced by an oxygen hydrogen.
Yeah.
And this is the active ingredient that actually gets you high on mushrooms.
Interesting.
And this is a very different experience than DMT.
Right.
And
they're so similar. And in some ways, they trigger the same kinds of cascade of neurotransmitters, right? I mean...
Right. Now, if you... here's the one that I ended up using for psycho-spiritual. This one I did take. This is called Ibogaine. It's got the same thing as the 5-methoxy-DMT. Actually, if you break this bond here and flex these around a little bit.
You can see the similarity. Yeah.
Up to this point, it is 5-methoxy-DMT.
Yeah. Right.
But these 7 other carbons kind of bend it around and anchor it. And we're not sure exactly why, but maybe they sort of present that side of the molecule. Or maybe in the receptor, this part kind of jams it in and gets it stuck in there. This guy, Ibogaine, can be used to interrupt a heavy addiction, like an opiate addiction. This can reset the neurotransmitters. And in a much smaller dose, and usually used with the whole iboga root bark, can be used for psychospiritual healing.
Now, that's what I want to talk about, because you went to Costa Rica after Sue's passing. Tell me why you wanted to do that.
I was having a lot of trouble with some of it was survivor guilt. Why should she die and not me?
Yeah.
And she said, you know, don't let anybody tell you I lost my battle against cancer. I fought hard. I never gave up. And I won 5 more years with my friends and family. But I went to Costa Rica to take this. It's illegal in the U.S., so I went to a place in Costa Rica, and I did 2 rounds of it, and I got to actually meet with her spirit. I got to meet my own soul, too. And this is pretty amazing, because I didn't believe in spirits.
Yeah.
You're
a scientist.
I'm a skeptic.
Yeah.
A scientist. To me, faith, which is about believing without evidence, to me, that seems pretty foolish.
You said you were an atheist as a kid. Are you still an atheist?
I don't believe in God, a supernatural God that watches my thoughts and everything, but I think spirits are real.
There's something else going on in addition to what
I think consciousness is much more complex than we think of it.
Yeah.
Instead of consciousness being sort of the outcome of a brain functioning, enough neurons firing. Think of it as a generator for consciousness. The brain is definitely involved in consciousness, but I think consciousness, there's something much bigger going on, and the brain is giving us either tuning into consciousness or able to access consciousness. This is my main research now. The thing I want to do most is bridge spirituality and science about consciousness. I want to know what's true. I don't want to believe something because it's convenient to believe it or I want to believe it. That doesn't make anything true. I want to know, what is the truth about consciousness? How does it work? And I'm firmly convinced it's much more rich and complicated than just generators. Brains generate consciousness.
Did you think this before you went to Costa Rica?
No, I didn't.
You were just in such pain that you went somewhere just to...
Well, I wanted to deal... Well, one of the things that I asked Sue's spirit, I was worried that she was mad at me for letting her die. Mm-hmm. No. She's happy for the time we had together. And she wants me to go on and live the rest of my life and just not forget about her. But that's where the biggest healing came, is kind of being given support and permission from her to move on. And I feel her around me. I can feel her spirit with me.
And you don't think this is a hallucination or this is some sort of drug-induced...
One can't prove that. I don't think it is. If I had to bet money. So I can't, like... This is what, so why am I so interested in consciousness? I want to know what's real, and I want to be able to prove what's real.
Right.
The quality of interaction was way beyond anything I've seen in a hallucination or a dream. I actually felt more real than reality, which is a sort of strange way to put it. But I think it was real.
This was a guided experience, too. Went somewhere with people who had a lot of knowledge about doing this. Is this a traditional ritual?
I had two shamans. It was in a fire circle, and they talked about the Bwiti tradition in Africa.
So this is an African tradition?
Yes.
Use of this root?
From Gabon, Africa.
Okay.
And they gave us this medicine. And the first night, I couldn't reach the spirit world. There was a healing process, waves of imagery washing through me. And then the second day was physical activity, zip lines and a spiritual shower where we got bathed in African herbs and left our old clothes behind and put on new clothes and were told not to look back. And
this is something that's been observed with other hallucinogenics, which is that the set and the setting very much influences the experience.
Oh, yeah.
That you need to come to it
this
with a spiritual point of view.
This is not something I would ever take by myself. And the boga is something I don't expect I'll ever take again in my life.
Yeah.
It was a one-time healing that I needed, and I don't think I'll need to do it again.
How did you find these people?
I did a lot of research, and I talked to a lot of people and found out who was good at this.
So you knew that there was something that you had wanted to find. You were looking for somebody who could do this.
Yes. And I researched it, and there are a number of iboga healers, and I learned about the difference between iboga and ibogaine.
Why iboga?
It's very different than, say, LSD.
Yeah. Was the experience different than your...
Totally different.
Yeah.
Totally different. LSD, very cognitive, very crisp, and you know, it amplifies all your senses.
Yeah.
It'll have some ego dissolution where no difference between you and that rock over there. But this was heart-centered. This is heart medicine. And really, I mean, not physically the heart, but, you know, metaphorically the heart. This medicine was really healing and allowed me to access a spirit world that I've never accessed before with anything, with LSD, with mushrooms.
Now, you were a scientist, so you were trying... part of your agenda here was to see if you could demonstrate that there was something more than just...
Yeah,
imagination.
I tried to even set up some traps. I told several friends, I'm going to take this medicine on January 7th, and I'm going to try and come to you in a dream. I want you to write down a message to give me.
So they're in the United States, you're in Costa Rica, and you're going to somehow come to them in a dream.
Come to them in their dream.
Yeah.
And you write down a message, and when I come back, I'll compare notes with you and see if I got it.
Great idea.
And I told my daughter, I said, you know, I'm going to try and contact your mom, and if I can... I'm going to ask her to tell me something that she's told you, but she's never told me. And sure enough, when I was able to contact Sue's spirit, she said, I said, tell me something you've told Amanda, but you never told me. She says, you're the bestest daughter ever. And she telepathed it into my head.
She didn't even speak it.
Her lips didn't move, but she telepathed it into my head in her voice. I could definitely hear her voice. And I felt Well, that's sort of a trick because it's no secret. I've heard her say that before, but she hasn't said it to me because I'm not her daughter. And the other friends, I couldn't get message from. They were asleep or couldn't give me a message, and so I didn't come back with the hard proof that I want. A scientist really wants proof.
Right.
And that's what makes science work, is that every scientist is skeptical about every other scientist. They try to reproduce it. And if it doesn't reproduce, then they want to know, well, what's the difference between what I did and what they did, and narrow it down and figure out what's actually the truth. So you don't believe something because you want to believe it. You believe it because the evidence forces you to believe it. And direct experience is, really an important piece of evidence.
Yeah.
And I'm still looking for how to find out what the heck consciousness is. Another avenue I've been exploring is lucid dreaming. So we have an unconscious part of our mind and a conscious part. And we wake up from a dream, and for a little while, the dream is fresh in our mind. But, a few minutes later, after you're really awakened, it's gone. It slips away. Well, lucid dreaming is a technique of keeping both parts of your mind alive at the same time when your conscious part can be aware of what's going on in your subconscious. That's, again, part of consciousness. How is that functioning? Where is the subconscious? What does it mean? Why do we have dreams? How do we have dreams? The pineal gland is in the middle of the brain and is situated right above the superior and inferior colliculi, the two main relays for vision and audition. It's possible, but not proven yet, that the pineal gland may be dripping DMT onto the superior and inferior colliculi.
A small amount.
Well, every mammal studied has endogenously generated DMT in small amounts. Lots of plants have it. So we don't know. A scientific study would be great to run a thin cannula catheter up the spine so that it ends near the pineal gland and has inlets every centimeter going down, and measure the concentration of DMT as someone's having a REM dream. That's an experiment you could do and find out. But what you would be finding out is the how of dreaming.
Yeah.
But there's another question, which is the why. Why do we dream?
Yeah.
And I think that it's not just a matter of garbage collecting memory.
That's kind of the current thinking.
I think that there's too much.
There's some processing going on in the brain.
Well, one way of thinking about it, like garbage collection or concordance building, to consolidate memory, would be most of our life we see images and we have emotional reaction to them.
Mm-hmm.
Saber tooth, run. Not cyber tooth, stay. Mm-hmm. Right. And maybe a different way of consolidating memory would be to start with emotions and say, what images does that call up that are belong with those? But it just seems like there's too much plot or too much narrative in a dream.
That doesn't surprise me, though. That's what the human brain is designed to do, is to take disparate facts and turn it into a story.
Well, the job of the brain is to make a model of the world
complex
enough that it can predict what's going to happen next.
So you don't get it by that saber-toothed tiger.
Right.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be better than not.
Just have to work.
Right? Yeah. And it can actually be erring on the side of conservative.
Right.
Like, maybe that's just a pussycat and it's all right if I run from it.
Right.
Right.
No harm done.
But as long as I don't get eaten by the saber-tooth.
Right.
Right. So there's a lot to learn about how the mind works.
Yeah.
And one way of thinking about it is mind is sort of a process that runs on the hardware brain. You know, like we have a computer and we've got software, Mac Paint in this case, that runs on it.
Right.
Mac Paint is software. The Mac is hardware.
So our brain is the Mac.
But I think some of the information we're starting to find out is that mind is not just a process running on the hardware brain.
Right.
And one way of thinking about it is that the brain may be tuning into some consciousness that's bigger than the individual, that there's a global consciousness. And I want to figure out what the heck is going on.
How would you propose going about that?
Well,
you wouldn't be the first person to want to know this, by the way. I think this is an age-old quest.
Well, one experiment that's about to go on that I'm looking forward to hearing what happens, when DMT is given IV to someone, they don't develop a tolerance. Give them the same amount of DMV an hour later, and DMV, that's Department of Motor Vehicles.
One never wants to give anybody DMV. That's a very bad trip.
You give DMT again an hour later, it has the same effect.
Yeah.
So if there's no tolerance, then the experiment would be to put an infusion pump on a person, monitor the DMT level in their blood, and keep them at a certain level for 24 hours, give them enough time to, if they're going to interact with otherworldly beings, actually be an ambassador or a anthropologist exploring.
I come in
what if
peace.
They came back with information we don't have now?
Right.
So, like in the movie Arrival.
Right.
The key thing that the heptapods gave humans was a language that allowed them to think differently, such that they could think beyond linear notions of time and experience time in a nonlinear fashion, because their language was nonlinear. So, proof that you actually interacted with other consciousness might be coming back with technologies we didn't have before.
Could be actually the first contact.
Come back with, yes.
Yeah.
So this experiment is going to happen fairly soon, not in the U.S., but it'll be a brave psychonaut has volunteered. He may not come back at
this
all.
This is a lot like the guy who says, I'll go to Mars. You may not be able to get me back. I'll stay.
Yeah. Well, he may have a broken mind afterwards.
Yeah. And that's a brave thing to volunteer for.
Not a wise thing to jump into.
No.
But other ways. So supposing I talk to somebody who'd listened to one of your triangulation broadcasts, and I've listened to it, and I said, and the next question he asked was this, and then the other guy answered that, and my friend who listened to it said, and then he asked this question and answered that question. Yeah, that's what I heard too. That would lead me to believe that I hadn't just made up the stuff about triangulation in my head.
There was a common experience.
That there was an external reality that we both tuned into.
Yes.
Okay. What kind of trip reports from people meeting otherworldly beings would lead one to believe that the otherworldly beings weren't just being fabricated in each individual person's mind?
Right.
So, I don't know. Right at this point, what I'm doing mostly is just reading.
Yeah. Show us some of the books, because I think there are some people who might be interested in what you're talking about. Some people who might be horrified by what you're talking about. I think it's good to have an open mind. This is actually a book that just came out from Michael Pollan.
Yes. Michael writes about food.
Yeah.
I wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma and a number of other food books.
Great food writer, yeah.
And this book he's written about, it's called How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence.
Is there a science of psychedelics going on right now?
There is. In fact, there's a resurgent, a renaissance of research in psychedelics. What happened back in the 60s when Timothy Leary said, everybody tune in, tune out, and drop out, that did a lot of damage toward psychedelic research. Yeah. So research that was been going on just got shut down cold
for, it was 25, seen as a recreational
for 25 years.
Drug, and
well, it was put in the same class as heroin, which is a nasty drug you don't want to take. You never want to take heroin.
Right.
And it shut down a lot of research. But now what's happening is a little more is being found about how these psychedelics can help in real situations like post-traumatic stress, anxiety of death before cancer. Like when somebody is for sure going to die, you might say, well, what's the harm in letting them try something? But actually, the experience is when people do a deep psychedelic experience, they let go of the fear of dying. And one of the reasons is psychedelics can transcend the ego. And you can actually step outside of your ego to a higher standing point where you see, oh, there's Bill's ego kind of laid out across the horizon like a thin coat of paint, and there's someplace else to stand and observe it.
I am not not Bill.
And
not
one
Leo.
Can experience something that I read about, I haven't experienced myself, called God consciousness,
right.
Where you're bigger than an individual,
right.
And bigger than the ego, certainly. And you can kind of look at your ego and say, oh, well, that's like a suit of clothing you'd wear for a job or a costume you'd wear for a party.
Yeah.
So this book talks about, he actually did three different experiences with a therapist in a guided situation, in a very carefully controlled situation. He did LSD and 5-methoxy-DMT and psilocybin. And as he describes his experiences there, and one way he talks about it is that you can write about food by watching somebody eating, but you can't really understand food until you take a few forkfuls.
You got a bite.
Yeah. So one of the things that has been found recently is instead of psychedelics lighting up a certain area of the brain, actually part of what they're doing is calming down an area of the brain, something called the default mode network. As we get older, we get sort of jump to conclusion things.
Yeah.
You hear the start of a sentence and you know what they're going to say next.
We've
you don't even
there,
listen to
that.
The rest of it,
yeah.
right? And it's a little bit like having he talks about like having a hill full of snow, and you can toboggan it down it in any direction. But pretty soon there are tracks on it. And if you start in any one direction, you'll just join one of the existing tracks. And if you look at children's brains, so we now have methods to put a live human being into a fMRI scanner and measure activity inside the brain while they're under influence of one of these psychedelics. And you look at an adult brain and a child's brain, the child has a lot more thinking outside of the box, a lot more creativity, a lot less developed default mode network. When a psychedelic calms down the default mode network, you start thinking outside of the box.
Yeah.
And this can help with addictive type behaviors, because that's, and it can help with depression. You get locked into a way of thinking about yourself that's not healthy.
It helped you, didn't it? I mean, it really transformed you.
I'll show you a picture of me when I got back from Iboga Land. All right, so there I'm there.
Okay, this is before.
Well, no, I'm there. That's
this
after,
is,
actually.
This is there,
but
okay.
This is.
That's a happy face.
So now I'm studying consciousness.
Whoa!
My main study now is consciousness.
That's great.
And I got the go ahead to.
Wait a minute!
This is my girlfriend.
A new girlfriend.
Yeah.
That's Kai.
With Sue's permission.
Oh.
With Sue's blessing.
Yeah.
This is Jingwen Kai.
Nice.
There's my 66th birthday. And I started a discipline, a kind of meditation. I've never been good at going to the gym and working out on the machines, or at sitting cross-legged and flushing thoughts out of my mind.
Yeah.
So I took this pond that's next to my house, and for 3 to 5 hours a day for 5 months, I cleaned it with a rake by hand.
There's precedent for that in Japanese gardening.
It's a physical meditation.
Yeah.
And when I do it, it kind of like clears my head.
Yeah.
And now I have a beautiful pond.
You're like Monet and his Giverny. You're going to do water lily paintings, maybe?
And Kai has got me into sailing.
Oh, that's great.
So good outdoor exercise.
That's awesome.
I invented some interlocking wooden building blocks.
This you saw, some of you saw at Maker Faire. Bill was there with these building blocks.
Here's kids building stuff with the building blocks, and I gave a handout to their parents. Here's how you can make them with just a table saw and a miter saw. You can make them easily.
Have you put this on your website, or is there somewhere else people could access that?
It's on my Facebook. There's a write-up about that.
Okay, yeah. People would like the plans, I'm sure. That's really cool what you could do with that.
Yeah.
You really are a physical learner, aren't you?
Kinesthetic.
Kinesthetic.
Yeah. I got to hold it, feel it,
yeah.
play
Isn't
with
that
it.
Interesting? Yeah.
Here's, Kai and I went to Bhutan. This was an amazing adventure.
This is somewhere I've
Bhutan is up in the Himalayas, next to Nepal. It's sandwiched between China and India, but it's way up in the Himalayas. And they are known as the country of gross national happiness. They give an annual survey, an anonymous survey, and 90% of the people rate themselves as very happy. And they do it because instead of saying, do I have more than the next guy, they say, do I have enough for myself and my family?
Yeah.
And we went there, and here's...
It sounds like universal basic income. Are you advocating... Look at that. Where is that?
That's called the Tiger's Nest, and we climbed up to it.
Looks like Shangri-La.
And big prayer wheels. Prayer wheels have prayers inside them, and they spin them.
Yes.
And supposedly that sends prayers up to the gods and creates karma.
This is Buddhist.
Yes.
Yes.
In fact, they have an interesting variation of Buddhist. Karma in many Buddhist things, if you show compassion or generosity to someone else, your next incarnation gets the benefit.
It's a point system.
Right. And what they do there is different. The benefactor is all sentient beings, and the time frame is now.
Like it better. I like that.
You don't have to wait for...
Next life.
Next life.
That's nice. Do they believe in reincarnation, or...?
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
But you don't have to believe in reincarnation to be kind to your neighbor, because it pays forward immediately.
That's even better.
Here's a little, I use photo cards as a little reminder of our trip.
And these are the clothes you wore in Bhutan.
Yeah. They do a lot of good things there. They have benefited from a series of really good kings. It's a monarchy. And
that's an argument for a king.
Well, King IV did something that would be impossible in the U.S. They had a problem of wealth disparity. And so he said, okay, every Bhutanese citizen is going to own land. And if you own more than 25 acres, say which 25 you're keeping, and we're going to surrender the rest. We'll redistribute it.
Wow.
And with an acre of land, you can feed a family of six with just growing potatoes.
So everybody has enough.
Yeah.
That's a good solution.
They did a lot of things good, like, in the main city, Thimphu, there's a stand in the middle where a traffic directing officer says, okay, you go next and you go next. They tried replacing that with a red, yellow, green stoplight. And it lasted 3 days. They said, we don't like it. It's too impersonal.
We
Give
want
us
a human.
Back our officer. There are no traffic lights anywhere in the country.
They're people.
Right. The king, King V, is beloved. People wear little badges.
They number them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5?
Well, for shorthand, he's the son of King IV.
Okay.
In fact, King IV decided that all kings should retire by age 65, and he himself retired at 51, turned over the keys to his son. He decided that we should have a prime minister and a democracy, that we should be able to replace our king if he's not doing a good job. And King V walks around the capital city with no bodyguard.
Wow.
Nobody wants to assassinate him. And in fact, people are graceful enough that they don't even accost him and ask for a selfie.
Right. Right.
They do a lot of good things there. They were bringing power into one town where there's this valley where the black-neck cranes nest. They travel over Asia and they nest there for the winter. And, they were bringing power into it, and they were worried that the power lines might be bad for the cranes and might be ugly. They talked it over, and they decided to trench and bring in the power underground, where in the long run it's cheaper because it doesn't get blown down when the winds.
Right.
But they do a lot of things by doing it for the right thing. Now, what they do to minimize... So health care is free. Hospitals have no way of billing. Medicines are free. Doctors are free. Treatments are free. But... You got a lot of poor people down in India that if they walk up the hill, they could totally swamp the medical system. So they said, well, we want tourism, but we don't. We want high value, low impact tourism. So it's easy to get a visa to visit Bhutan, But you have to pay $250 per person per day ahead of time. And that might sound like a lot until you realize it covers your, all of your lodging, all of your meals, your guide, your driver.
I'm there.
All of your entrance.
I'm on my way. Can I move there?
Yeah. Anyway,
we need to take a break. But can you stick around and we'll do some more? Because we haven't done half of the things I wanted to talk to you about.
Okay.
Phil Atkinson. I think, and I have to admit, I was hoping that we would get more than one episode out of this, and I think we will. Bill Atkinson, to find out more, BillAtkinson.com. Make sure you get a copy of Photocard on your iPhone or iPad and use it. And next, I guess we'll do the General Magic Leap. We'll do that next episode. Thanks for joining us, everybody. We do Triangulation on Fridays, 3 p.m. Pacific, until whenever. Carson said the only stopping point is the next day at 11 a.m. when the tech guy starts. So sometime between 3 p.m. and 11 a.m. the next day, we'll end. If you want to watch us live, go to twit.tv/live. You can watch us. We're producing at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. That'd be 2200 UTC on Friday evenings. Always something interesting. Always a great conversation. You can also get on-demand versions of every show we do. In fact, you can get the older episodes with Bill if you want to catch up. For before next week, go to twit.tv/TRI. You can just search for Bill Atkinson. You'll find it very quickly. You can also subscribe in your favorite podcatcher, and you'll get it automatically that way. Please do subscribe. That way you won't miss an episode. Thanks for joining us, and I'll see you next week with more Bill Atkinson on Triangulation. Bye-bye.